I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
And we co-host Writing Roots.
It's a 10-minute podcast in which we, an author,
and her editor,
cover lessons we've learned about the writing process.
So whether you're an experienced storyteller or still working on that first book,
now is the time to check us out.
Writing Roots is available on iTunes, Spotify, and anywhere you find your podcasts. And don't forget to always
write selfishly.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
Sometimes we, in the debates about the Declaration and the broader debate about America, we might conclude that, Jefferson wrote it, Jefferson read Locke, therefore it's Locke. Well, there's some locking influence there. There's some important locking influences there. But there's some other influences there as well. And so I think it's very important to really kind of understand it in this broader context.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. And that's Dr. Matthew Spaulding, our first guest on today's program. Dr. Spaulding is Vice President of Washington Operations and Dean of the Van Andel Graduate School of Government at Hillsdale in D.C. We talked at length with Dr. Spaulding about Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration of Independence. Dr. Spaulding, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Scott.
And thanks for hosting me today as I visit in Washington at the Kirby Center, the Boyle Radio Studio here, a magnificent layout. It's always a pleasure to be here in Washington and to talk. We've talked previously on the program about the Declaration of Independence. I wanted to spend some time today speaking specifically about Thomas Jefferson and his contributions, large as they are, to the Declaration. When we think of the Declaration of Independence, we know Congress had appointed a committee. So how did the Declaration chiefly then become the work of one Thomas Jefferson?
that's actually a great question. The history leading up to this moment, I think, if I can make it just one step backwards, it is very important. If you recall what gives rise to the American Revolution or all these various things the British are doing after the end of the French Indian War, so that decade preceding it, they're raising taxes. They start enforcing their laws. They eventually are housing troops. So this has been building up. The colonies start agitating, and they eventually call a Continental Congress. There are two Continental Congresses, the first in 1774-75, and then the second comes back again in 1775-1776. And from the beginning, there's a divide and a debate. One of the things we want to study when we study this is this debate. How do we reconcile with the British and others who early on? Well, how do we start an independent nation? It gets to a point, especially after you get the outbreak of hostilities in April of 1775, Lexington and Concord. If you recall, the British send troops out from Boston to find these rebel rousers who are supposedly collecting weapons. It gets to a point where we're going to need to kind of take the ultimate position, which is to declare independence. That crucial moment becomes when Virginia in June of 1776, we've now kind of been developing almost for a year now after Lexington Concord. This is just getting worse and worse. They've appealed, make their final appeals, and finally Richard Henry Lee of Virginia introduces his motion for independence. Well, at that point, they really knew that's where things were going to go. That motion triggered a number of things. One was to write a Declaration of Independence, which we'll come back to. Another was to begin thinking about what a constitutional government might look like. This doesn't take off until a number of years later, eventually becomes the Articles of Confederation, which was kind of started out at the same time. And the third thing that motion calls for is developing a relationship with a foreign nation, which becomes our alliance with France. So They're doing the things one would have to do to get ready for independence. And among those, they create a committee to write a declaration. That committee is made up of John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, the three most famous, but also Roger Sherman of Connecticut and Robert Livingston of New York. Committee of five. Committees hardly ever work. the short story, and if you've ever seen the there's a great musical that came out in the 1970s called, I believe it was called 1776. Mm-hmm. It's actually pretty good. It's kind of, it says 1970s for it. But the short story is that Franklin, Adams, and Jefferson kind of took the lead. Franklin at this point is an older, eminent Greece. He's not really involved. Adams had proven himself to be a great writer, as Thomas Jefferson had. They've both written a lot of pamphlets. But John Adams annoys people. He's gruff. And he has been twisting arms to get this Declaration of Independence. He knows this, and in a great act of statesmanship, John Adams writes Jefferson and tells him to write it, because I annoy people, and you're from Virginia, and Virginia must take the lead on this. And so he tells Jefferson to write it. That's what causes him to be the main author.
So if Adams is perceived, and rightfully so, it appears to be a pain in the behind to many, what's the general perception of Jefferson at this time?
I would add, Adams is a pain, but because he's a pain, his nickname actually is the Atlas of Independence, which is to say that he's the one that legislatively accomplished independence. He's the guy that got the legislation passed, as we say. He's a doer. He's a revolutionary. He's a mover and shaker in the Continental Congress. Jefferson, on the other hand, he's written some extremely eloquent things already. He's wrote the Virginia's instructions to the Continental Congress. He's written essays. He's written a number of things that have shown he's an eloquent writer. Beyond that, he's not quite as well known yet. He's not yet become, obviously, governor of Virginia, president, other great things he gets involved in. He's not yet gone over and done mm-hmm. his work as ambassador to France. He's a good writer. He's younger, a little bit younger than Adams. He's the youngest, I believe, of that whole committee. Mm. And so they wanted to give it to the young guy who's a great writer, who they could rely on to bat this out in pretty quick order. If you recall, the motion is in June. The declaration is written somewhat quickly over the course of the next several weeks. It's debated. One of the things that is important to look at in our history, if you want to try to understand these things, is the debate over the declaration in the Continental Congress. They famously strike some things in it, including a reference to a condemnation of the slave trade, mm-hmm. which Jefferson wanted in there, but certain southern colonies wouldn't allow it. They also add some references to God, which is actually very significant, because the Declaration has several important references to God in it. So that debate is important. So this is all going on, so that backs us up a little bit more. And the Declaration is actually passed, not on July 4th, but on July 2nd. And then it's signed on July 4th. So really, when you think about it and put this together, and I don't know how many words the Declaration is, but it's a, writing shorter is actually is harder to write.
Yeah.
It's a pretty impressive accomplishment, given that we didn't have, photocopiers and computers and clip and pastes.
Right.
And, it was a great accomplishment.
Dr. Spaulding, we'll pause right there and return in a moment. Talking with Dr. Matthew Spaulding, Vice President of Washington Operations and Dean of the Van Andel Graduate School of Government at Hillsdale in D.C., about Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration of Independence. More in a moment. Remember, you can sign up to get an email every time there's a new episode of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Head to radiohour.hillsdale.edu
and enter your email address, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. You also can find older episodes of the program there, too. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. To get an email every time there's a new episode of the program, go to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your email address, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We've been talking with Dr. Matthew Spaulding from Hillsdale in D.C. about the writing of the Declaration of Independence and Thomas Jefferson's involvement in it. Dr. Spaulding, what do we know about how Jefferson approached this task? How did he see his role, and where did he draw influence? Where did he take instruction from? How did he do it?
Well, part of it, and another thing, important thing to recall here is the extent to which the American founders, this was a really this unique generation of individuals who were extremely well read, who were had not only read a lot of ideas of political thought and political philosophy, they knew their British history very well, they read each other, and this had been going on for at least a decade and a half, so they're intentionally involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of it was he's working off of that intensity of the conversation. He has before him, and he makes references in his own letters to, writers. In one letter, he famously talks about Aristotle, Cicero, Locke, and Sidney, which is a reference to John Locke. Mm-hmm. Algernon Sidney, they were both two great writers of the Glorious Revolution. Cicero, the great Roman. Aristotle, the great classic, the great Greek. He talks about Aristotle, Cicero, Locke, Sidney, etc. But he refers to the great Republican writers, as he understood these as great Republican. So they clearly have imbibed all of this. Jefferson is very familiar with all of these writings. He's read the pamphlets. He's read John Adams. He's read James Wilson, who's a great legal thinker of the time. So he's got this great amount of knowledge in his head that he's working with, and he says he's not trying to invent something new.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to give reflect the common mind, right, the sentiment of the time in doing this, and he tries to condense that down, and I think it's fair to say that based on everything I've studied, my teachers have studied, just reading, I mean, it is an amazing condensation, especially that second paragraph that begins, "We hold these truths to be self-evident," of the whole political theory of the American founding. It's quite impressive.
Dr. Matthew Spaulding with us talking about the Declaration of Independence and Thomas Jefferson's writing of the Declaration. Congress eventually approves. There are debates. There are things taken out, as you alluded to earlier. But in your mind, what makes the Declaration a Jeffersonian document? Do we see his specific fingerprints in places in the Declaration?
Well, let me answer it this way. I think in some ways we do see his fingerprints, turns of phrases. But I think in here I give I want to give Jefferson a great amount of credit by saying this. When I alluded to earlier that he writes a famous letter to Henry Lee, in which he says the object of the Declaration of Independence was not to find new principles or new arguments never before thought of, not merely to say things which have never been said before, but to place before mankind the common sense of the subject in terms so plain and firm as to command their assent. I think that we do see Jefferson's fingerprints on it, but I think it's misleading to say it's just Jefferson's fingerprints. We see the fingerprints of that whole generation of thinkers, of this founding generation, with its roots back to those great thinkers before them. And in that sense, it is not only a beautiful written work in and of itself, and Thomas Jefferson gets credit for those the words, but it is a beautiful condensation of what the founders themselves thought, the common mind of the time, and I think he should also be given credit for that. It's too often. Sometimes we in the debates about the Declaration and the broader debate about America, we might conclude that Jefferson wrote it. Jefferson read Locke, therefore it's Locke. Well, there's some Lockean influence there. There's some important Lockean influences there, but there are some other influences there as well. And so I think it's very important to really kind of understand it in this broader context.
You mentioned that Jefferson included a charge initially that the king had waged cruel war against human nature by introducing slavery and allowing slave trade into the American colonies. Congress debated, removed it. What did that debate look like? Was it ever particularly close to remaining in the final document?
It got to the Continental Congress, and they debated it, and they had a vote, and it was important. This is kind of one of those great what-if questions, but also a great prudential question. You're about to declare independence, which means war, against the strongest nation in the world. You need unanimity. South Carolina and I think Georgia, if I'm remembering correctly, objected to a condemnation of the slave trade. Jefferson objected to them taking that out. But the Congress ultimately said, no, we've got to remove that. What they didn't remove, and what is clear from the debate, they did not remove a general statement that all men are created equal and endowed with inalienable rights. From the context of that debate and from the context of what others, great thinkers later, like Lincoln or Martin Luther King, right, that was the dagger, if you will, at the heart of slavery. So as much as we might recognize that, well, there's this condemnation of slave trade, and it was taken out, what does that mean? Well, I would have preferred it stayed in there. Jefferson wanted it to stay in there. The Constitution postponed the time at which we could abolish the slave trade. It turned out that he was president when the Constitution allowed the abolition of the slave trade, and Congress immediately abolished the slave trade, and he signed legislation with full federal authority to abolish slavery. So they got around to it.
Yeah.
But the more important thing that was in there was this statement that all men are created equal. Indeed, to come back to our general question, why is the Declaration of Independence important? Well, it's important because it declares independence as a practical matter. It begins this train of events. But the most important thing is it declares that principle which really drives American history. Lincoln later famously writes a great letter, which I can't quote in particular, so don't hold me to it. Where he says, "All honor to Jefferson, the man who in a mere revolutionary document had the foresight to put there an abstract principle applicable to all men at all times." That's why the Declaration is different, and that in turn is why American history is different.
Dr. Matthew Spaulding, Vice President of Washington Operations and Dean of the Van Andel Graduate School of Government at Hillsdale in D.C., talking about Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration. Dr. Spaulding, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Great to be with you, Scott.
Up next, we talk with New York Times bestselling author James Rickards, recently on Hillsdale's campus, to discuss the cashless society. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
KCNR Shasta is also broadcasting at K243CT Reading.
I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Leah Esses.
And we co-host Writing Roots.
It's a 10-minute podcast in which we, an author,
and her editor,
cover lessons we've learned about the writing process.
Writing Roots is available on iTunes, Spotify, and anywhere you find your podcasts. And don't forget to always
write selfishly.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wynn Carpenter and Terry Raposa. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archives link.
ACA, come out and play. Have you seen the bill we all have to pay? The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
This is Carl Bott and Ted Leidy. We want to invite you to our new show, Man Up, the fourth Thursday of each month, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
Man Up, 6 to 7 p.m., where we explore the lost art of being a man.
Spirits, cigars, and hit the ground running when you get up in the morning. That's what Man Up's going to be about.
Oh, don't forget motorcycles, guns, and hard work every day.
And those things that men talk about when women aren't around.
That's right. Even cooking sometimes.
Even cooking sometimes. People, places, and things.
Serving your family, your community, and your country.
Man Up. Fourth Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 p.m. right here on Free Fire Radio.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Common Senior Living. One of the most rewarding things about what I do is watching the positive transformation that often occurs when a senior moves here to our beautiful, independent retirement community. Seniors can become isolated, find it hard to eat good, healthy meals, and even just get around. I call this a failure to thrive. At River Commons, we solve those challenges. You are surrounded by friendly people with similar life experiences. Chef Shalisa and her crew provide three delicious and healthy meals daily. Activities Director Ernie always has a wide variety of things to do, from arts and crafts to outings on our 25-passenger bus. Plus, we provide utilities, cable TV, scheduled transportation, weekly housekeeping, and more. We see seniors go from survive to thrive, and that is just a wonderful thing. Call today for a tour or luncheon a tour and experience River Commons for yourself. 221-2121 or on the web river-commons.com.
It's a bright new day. The sun is shining. The birds are singing. And there's never been a better day to try Mount Shasta spring water. Hi, I'm Bob the Drop. I come from a protected spring at the base of Mount Shasta. I'm bottled at the source. It doesn't get more cool and refreshing than that. And it's delivered right to your door. Yep, pure and simple. Naturally, the best. Start your bright new day by calling 1-800-922-6227 to order some of the best tasting water on the planet. Mount Shasta spring water.
KCNR invites you to join us the second Friday of the month starting at 8 a.m. for the Gorman Law Hour, featuring local attorney Patrick Gorman, a legal expert when it comes to injured workers, compensation claims, and employee claims. So, if you have a legal question or just wonder whether or not you have a legal issue or problem, talk to Patrick Gorman, attorney at law, during the Gorman Law Hour, starting at 8 a.m. the second Friday of the month on KCNR. The Sikh Cultural Education Center and SCAR, in partnership with the Cottonwood Community Center, are having a free COVID-19 vaccination clinic Tuesday, February 8th, from noon until 6 p.m. All COVID-19 vaccines will be available, including boosters, at the Cottonwood Community Center at 20595 Gas Point Road. Kids 5 to 11 and youths 12 to 17 must be accompanied by parents or guardians for consent. Come in and get vaccinated and enjoy free food while organizers hand out gift cards to vaccine recipients. No appointment needed. Free COVID-19 testing kits will also be available at the Cottonwood Community Center at 20595 Gas Point Road, Tuesday, February 8th, during the free COVID-19 vaccination clinic from noon until 6 p.m. Multilingual translators will also be available at this free clinic that is dedicated to the Cottonwood neighbors.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. For more information about Hillsdale College for prospective students, for alumni, or friends of Hillsdale, head to hillsdale.edu.
We're joined now by James Rickards, author of 6 books about money and finance. His most recent book is The New Great Depression. You can find out more at his website, jamesrickardsproject.com. He is on Hillsdale's campus as we speak for one of our CCA lecture series. This one's on The Great Reset, And his topic is Cashless Society. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
This is such an interesting topic, and there's so many different angles. When we talk about a cashless society, do you think of that as being debit credit cards? Where do we see cryptocurrency and Bitcoin and that play in? What's your definition, essentially, of a cashless society?
Well, that's a great question and a great place to start, because what's cash? Most people say, well, you know, I get some $20 bills in my pocket, or the Federal Reserve actually has a line item on their balance sheet called cash and coin in circulation, so they're counting quarters and dimes. In Philadelphia, we call it walking around money, but that's, you know, it's a common sense definition of cash. But if you look at the balance sheet of Apple or any corporation for that matter, on the asset side, the first line item is cash, and then you read the footnote, it says cash and equivalents. Well, what's that? Well, it includes bank deposits and highly liquid instruments, so maybe treasury bills, U.S. treasury bills, not treasury notes, et cetera, and perhaps money market funds. You're like, well, okay, the accountants are saying cash can be things in a bank, or basically you know, financial instruments of some kind. I always remind people that bank deposits, people go, well, my money's in the bank. I say, well, it's not your money, it's the bank's money. It's a bank deposit is an unsecured IOU from an occasionally insolvent financial institution. So what's cash is the first part of it. But yeah, we've come a long way to a cashless society. We're not all the way there yet. We take things for granted. You know, credit cards, debit cards, yeah, but PayPal, Venmo, Apple Pay, probably your paycheck, not everyone, but your paycheck probably is wired directly to your bank account with an ACH transfer. I remember my first job, they actually gave us pay envelopes with money stuffed inside. Yeah. I was like, you know, I think I made 80 bucks a week or something like that. It would be like $420 bills in there. But so we're very far along. You know, there's an old saying, we don't know who discovered water, but we're pretty sure it was not a fish. And the point being, a fish doesn't know what water is because the fish is immersed in the water. And you have to take the fish out of the water, and the fish goes, where's the water? Mm-hmm. Then they realize what it is. And we're in a digital electronic society, have been for 130 years, probably or longer, starting with the more like 180 years, starting with the telegraph. But we're so far along now, we take it all for granted, and we don't realize that cash is going away without any, you know, draconian orders.
How does the concept of money as a symbol of value change in a cashless society?
So the simplest definition of money is if I have confidence that you'll accept it from me in exchange for goods and services, and furthermore, you have confidence that you can give it to somebody else in exchange for their goods and services, that's money. So anything, you know, people say, well, the dollar's not backed by anything, or Bitcoin's not backed by anything. Well, for that matter, gold's not backed by anything. It's gold. It's atomic number 79. It's a nice, it's pretty metal. But there's nothing behind the element. But what I point out is that all forms of money are backed by the same thing, which is confidence. People have confidence, it can be money. If they don't, it's not. But what policymakers take for granted, and this is a huge blunder, is confidence is very fragile. It can be very easily lost, and it's very difficult to regain. And so one of my concerns is that our central bankers, for that matter, the Congress, are taking the dollar for granted. They're like, well, it's always going to be money, and so we can print as much as we want, we can spend as much as we want, have deficits as big as we want, trade deficits as big as we want. And yeah, there may be some policy implications behind it and choices, but it's always going to be money. And that is not true. So money is based on confidence. You know, the classic definition is a store of value, unit of account, medium of exchange. Store of value can really be any asset class. You know, real estate is not money, but it is a store of value. The question is, can you be all three? And that's a difficult question.
Talking with James Rickards about a cashless society here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Have we appropriately considered the consequences of going toward a cashless society? It's not happening overnight, as you mentioned earlier, but are we thinking enough about what this means for us?
No. And again, we're the fish in water. It just seems to kind of be happening. But some of the consequences are fairly fairly troubling. One thing the global elite saying, they want negative interest rates. And the solution to that is, okay, I put $100,000 in the bank, and the interest rate is -1%. So I go away for a year, and I come back, and I have $99,000. You took it. You didn't give me $1,000 of interest. You took $1,000 of interest. People say, well, there's a simple answer for that. I'll just take my money out of the bank and, you know, stick it in a tin can, bury it in the backyard or whatever. But at least when I come back a year later, I'll still have $100,000, and you won't. Digital money, elimination of cash is the pen. It's how you get people into the slaughterhouse of negative interest rates. So you have to eliminate cash so you have that option. But it goes beyond that. So, what if, they want to seize your account or freeze your account? Well, there are ways to do that, but it's a lot easier if all your money's in the account and they know exactly where it is. But think about it. Every point of purchase, you're under surveillance. They it's all digital message traffic. It's not, maybe encrypted by them, but not by you. So they know what you're buying, they know where you are, et cetera. I've worked on projects for the government where, you know, the question was, could you track terrorists using credit cards, for example? It's not easy, but the answer is, short answer is yes. But this is even more hands-on. Okay, so now you're under surveillance. They already have facial recognition software, and people go, well, wear a mask, you know, wear COVID, I'll wear a mask and a pair of sunglasses and a ski hat. Yeah, they have GAIT, G-A-I-T recognition software where everyone walks differently. Your walk is, yours or mine or anyone is as distinctive as a set of fingerprints. So good luck with the mask. They're watching your hips. But now it's even better. So, okay, let's just take that a step further. And we got people like, you know, Merrick Garland running around putting, you know, people who attend school board meetings under FBI investigation. What if you buy the wrong book? What if you donate to the wrong candidate? What if you affiliate with some organization that may be exercising free speech, but that the Department of Justice thinks it's your domestic terrorist, et cetera? Now they know, and they can put you on a watch list. They can assign an FBI officer, you know, agent to keep an eye on you, et cetera, and you wouldn't know it. And then you combine that with things like the Patriot Act, which has kind of soft workarounds of the Fourth Amendment. And everyone at the time was like, yeah, well, it's a good thing. We've got to get rid of these terrorists. Yeah, and it worked. But Rand Paul was one of the few, Senator Paul was one of the few who said at the time, not now with hindsight, but at the time, no, we're going down the wrong path here, and this is going to erode civil rights. And so you combine the shortcuts in the Patriot Act with this kind of total surveillance of every point of purchase, every online transaction, et cetera, a political motivation. It's hard. You get to a point pretty quickly where it's hard to see the difference between communist China and the United States.
And just to tie this together with the theme of the lecture series, The Great Reset, you talked a little earlier about how this might benefit some of the elites, the global elites. Is a cashless society, because people can go and see The Great Reset and what the plans are.
Sure.
Is it actually in those plans? Is this a stated goal of The Great Reset?
It absolutely is. And again, I'll point to Ken Rogoff's book, The Curse of Cash. But the short answer is, yeah, if you read Klaus Schwab's book, I think his book is called The Great Reset, which is the title of our colloquium here. And again, Ken Rogoff's book and Janet Yellen's recent statement. She's our Secretary of the Treasury in support of Biden administration plans to have complete readouts of every bank account in the country. And they're debating $600 or $10,000. Right. Well, I'm sorry, if you could be selling T-shirts. You're making more than $10,000. So they said, yeah, they're very explicit about it. And then you have to say why. And I think the reasons are the ones I mentioned, which are surveillance. And then sometimes people say, well, yeah, I'm okay with surveillance as long as they're only surveilling the bad guys. Well, what happens if you're the bad guy, according to them? That's the problem.
James Rickards, you can find his most recent book, The New Great Depression, and more at the website, jamesrickardsproject.com. Speaking here at Hillsdale College on cashless society. James, thanks so much for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you.
Up next, Stephen Smith from Hillsdale's English Department tells us more about Sir Thomas More. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at kcnr1460.com.
Join Sue McClain weekday mornings from 6 to 7 for the Sue McClain News Hour, where you'll hear the up-to-the-minute local news, national and international news, weather, sports, and a whole lot more. Followed by Free Fire Radio from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. with Carl and Linda Bach. From 9 to noon, be informed and laugh along with Armstrong and Getty, equal opportunity critics. From noon to 3, learn how to get out of debt with Dave Ramsey. From 3 to 6, don't miss constitutional expert Mark Levin. Monday through Thursday nights, starting at 6 p.m., we have local shows featuring everything from the paranormal, local history, North State Now, and unsung heroes of our area. From 7 to 9, tune in to Ben Shapiro, your local downtown radio station, KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at kcnr1460.com.
Join Aaron Ryan and Bill Cundiff for We the People Radio every Sunday from noon until 2. Our expert guests will give you the whole story rather than a bunch of sound bites. Our commercial-free archives are always available at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sponsored in part by Pape Machinery, located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, for all your local John Deere Ag and Turf products. Join us every Sunday from noon until 2, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them?
Every Monday from 6 to 8 p.m., join us at Radio Wasteland, your local guide to the unexplained and the unknown. Each week, we cover all things unexplained, from the moving stars in the sky to the things that go bump in the night. Visit us as we explore these topics and more as our in-studio team digs deeper with featured guests and listener call-ins. Mondays are rough, but now your overworked brain has a chance for some sweet relief with Radio Wasteland.
Radio Wasteland, Mondays at 6 on KCNR.
Aloha, this is Kevin, Operations Manager at Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. A professionally cleaned business sends a message to your paying customers. It says you are a company that cares about your image and always presenting the very best impression. Time after time, I've talked to clients who shopped for the lowest price and after a few months realized that their professional image was suffering. They didn't know who was actually coming into their offices to do the cleaning, and they just weren't getting the value they were paying for. Be wary of big name companies that take your money, then hire unknown contractors to do the work. Since 1987, Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, your local professionals, have been offering the best in office cleaning by our screened, bonded, and insured staff. Take pride in your business and say aloha to your customers with the professional cleaning services from Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. Call 221-5868, 221-5868, MauiBob'sOfficeCleaning.com.
Slow down. Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. My chiropractic and nutrition practice in downtown Reading has been helping people feel better for over 20 years. We pride ourselves in really listening to our patients and then tailoring a program of nutrition, chiropractic care, massage and exercise that's just right for you. The results can be dramatic. Call 244-7873. That's 244-7873. Thank you.
Hi, this is Senior Chief Rob Burrows with the Northern California Veterans Museum and Heritage Center, and I am your host every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 with Battlefield Expressions. Battlefield Expressions is where we talk about veterans issues, advocacy for our community, and those in our community who help support our veterans. Once again, join me every Saturday morning from 9 to 11, Battlefield Expressions on KCNR 96.5 at 1460 AM.
It's never too late to start at Shasta College. Late start classes and 8-week compressed classes are still available. To learn more about upskilling or reskilling for a current job or career, information is online at shastacollege.edu or call one of our counselors to see how easy it is to get enrolled at 530-242-7650. Shasta College offers in-person, hybrid, and online class options to fit your busy life and responsibilities. Financial aid is available. More at shastacollege.edu.
We're back
on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Follow us on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio. We're joined by Dr. Stephen Smith, Dean of Humanities, Temple Family Chair in English Literature, and Professor of English at Hillsdale College. Dr. Smith, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Smith, also the co-editor of a book released last year, The Essential Works of Thomas More, which we discuss here today. In a nutshell, for people who perhaps don't have a great knowledge, who was Thomas More?
He was the great Renaissance Englishman who published The Utopia, among many other writings, and who also served as a statesman for King Henry VIII. His life is very famously, especially the end of it, dramatized in Man for All Seasons, his conflict with Henry, and his death on Tower Hill. It also is the subject of a play on which Shakespeare collaborated. And so, in his life and in his death, one of the most famous English historical characters, he was also well regarded during his lifetime for his friendship, and also for his family, which was famous across Europe.
Now, this book, The Essential Works of Thomas More, why, tell us a little bit about it, first of all, and then why was it necessary? Why was it something that needed to be done?
Well, sometimes we take for granted the tools we have. A collected edition of Shakespeare's plays, a collected edition of Milton's poetry, the books we need to seriously study a first-rate major author. For Thomas More, there are translations and editions of Utopia available aplenty, but his other works, not so much so. So our goal was to collect in one volume the best of his English and Latin writings in prose and poetry and present them to the contemporary world. So it's a large book. It is a one-stop shop, if you will, for Thomas More. And it has a great supporting website as well, www.essentialmore.org.
People largely know about Thomas More's Utopia, which you referenced. We actually talked about it previously on the program with Dr. Matt Meehan from Hillsdale in D.C. And this is essential, though. So what are some of the other, perhaps lesser-known works that have been collected in this volume?
So Utopia, as you say, is his most famous book, but the riches of his authorship are pretty extraordinary. He has a life of the Renaissance intellectual, Pico. He has English and Latin poetry. He's written dialogues on theology. He's written a history of King Richard III, which became one of the major sources for William Shakespeare's breakthrough tragedy. In addition to all of these works, he left a long written legacy in letters. Letters to family and friends, letters to figures like Erasmus, a remarkable set of writings contained in the essential works.
Now, his theological works, what prompted More to go down that path, to begin writing about theological matters?
Well, More wrote about theological matters from beginning to end. His early poetry addresses the subject of death and the love of God, for example. That Life of Pico that I mentioned has as one of its central themes the love of God and theology. So the theology and the theological interest is present from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Now, later in his life, especially as things heated up in Europe with the Reformation, he entered into the fray, first assisting Henry in his response to Luther, and then writing, for example, the 1529 dialogue in which he addresses most of the Reformation controversies, including the relationship between faith and love, human freedom, the nature of the church, and so on. At the end of his life, when he was imprisoned in the Tower of London, he also wrote on theology, but here, with his own, you know, trial and looming death, I think, more in mind, he wrote a treatise on the Passion, for example, a treatise on the Blessed Body, his great work, A Dialogue of Comfort Against Tribulation, which C.S. Lewis thought should be on every man's shelf, And then finally, his last sort of broken off a work, The Sadness of Christ, a work in Latin that is a commentary on the Garden of Gethsemane.
Talking with Dr. Stephen Smith, his book, The Essential Works of Thomas More, he is co-editor on that. What about his historical writings? What might be distinctive about his historical writings, and do we still see some of that theological bend, his faith, his philosophy in those historical works as well?
Well, his History of Richard III is a fabulous piece of writing. It exists in two forms, English and Latin. I just love the English version to death. I'll confess freely, I'm a Shakespeare nut, so there's a reason for that.
Well known around campus.
But Moore's English is wonderful, and that work in particular, among my favorites. In it, you know, in that historical work, he takes up themes that preoccupy him across his whole lifetime. For example, the problem of tyranny, how tyranny happens in a country, how it is resisted or not resisted, why a tyrant succeeds, things like that. He also looks at a theme like human blindness and why the principal political actors in the history seem to suffer from this affliction in particular. And then also a great theme like law itself, mm-hmm. the nature of law, the way a tyrant might use law to perpetrate his tyranny. More was a great lawyer and a judge himself. In fact, he was voted, I think in 1999, the lawyer of the millennium in Great Britain. So he had interest in this subject as well. But that work in particular I recommend to listeners. I think it's just fascinating. It's also funny. It's witty. And that humor illuminates a very dark story in ways that remind me of Shakespeare as well.
How would you describe the influence that Moore's writing had upon those writers who would come?
Well, The Utopia is one of the great books of the Western world, and its publication, you know, launches an entire modern genre of utopian and dystopian fiction. Of course, that genre has its roots back in antiquity and everything, but it's been described as, you know, a book that launched 1,000 books up to our own day. So that is a very influential piece of writing. The other way to look at Moore, of course, involves his life, which has never ceased to fascinate readers, citizens, other authors. Of course, there's Man for All Seasons in the 20th century, but a lot of folks don't know that Shakespeare collaborated on a play version of Moore's life called Sir Thomas More, a play that was never produced, but which survives, and which we include in the appendix to The Essential Works. It's the only example that we have of a piece of literary writing in Shakespeare's own hand. We actually have the manuscript. So that play is mysterious, very interesting, and it's an example of a later group of writers responding to his life, and especially his death, and telling their version of it.
Dr. Stephen Smith, again, the website that goes along with the book is essentialmore.org.
Right, and there's also another website, thomasmorestudies.org, which is related as well, the Center for Thomas More Studies website.
So if you can't get enough from the essential works of Thomas More, there's always more, no pun intended, online. Dr. Stephen Smith is the co-editor of The Essential Works of Thomas More, also Dean of Humanities, Temple Family Chair in English Literature, and Professor of English at Hillsdale College. Dr. Smith, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Matt Spaulding from Hillsdale in D.C. talking about Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration. James Rickards here on Hillsdale's campus on the Cashless Society, and Stephen Smith on Sir Thomas More. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. You can hear new episodes every week on this station. You can also find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, Amazon Podcasts, and now iHeart. Search for The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Follow us on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio or find us on Facebook. Email us at radiohour@hillsdale.edu. The assistant producer of the show is Nate Esbenshade. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Do you love country music? Come see Curb recording artist Dylan Scott perform live in concert Friday, July 8th inside the Wind River Resort and Casino Event Center. Tickets are $60 plus fees.
For tickets, call 1-800-280-UWIN.
A must-see show. Country sensation Dylan Scott in concert at Wind River Resort and Casino Friday, July 8th. Concerts are better at the river.
Like 100 years ago, Simpson University began with a promise to be the gateway to world service. 30 years ago, we moved to Reading with a promise to serve the North State, graduating professionals who live and serve our growing community. Today, Simpson University continues to provide a Christ-centered education, graduating students with mature and infectious faith, critical competence, and a ready spirit to thrive as servant leaders around the world and at our backyard. Learn more about Reading's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
A jewel of the North State, a place we love to go and love being members.
The view, the best in the North State, from the restaurants, meeting rooms, and of course on the award-winning 18-hole golf course, Riverview Golf and Country Club. It's the place to belong.
Go in and meet the friendly staff today or go to their website at riverviewgolf.net and find out about their introductory memberships.
Riverview Golf and Country Club, corporate, social, tennis, fitness, and golf. Get it all. Become a member.
It's affordable and fun. Riverview Golf and Country Club.
Hi, my name's Nick Gardner. I have a show here on KCNR, Sunday mornings from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. every other Sunday. The name of my show is Poke the Hornet's Nest.
There's no mountain I can't climb. There's no tower too high. No plane that I can't learn how to fly. What do I gotta do to get through to you to show you there ain't nothing I can't take this chainsaw to?
I'm going to concentrate on local politics mainly, but we'll talk about national politics also. You'll get the view of the common citizen here in Redding, California. And remember, today is the first day of the rest of your life. Maybe it's a good time for a new perspective about what's been going on in our town, in our state, in our nation. I hope you tune in and hear the other side of the news.
Hi, this is Senior Chief Rob Burrows with the Northern California Veterans Museum and Heritage Center, and I am your host every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 with Battlefield Expressions. Battlefield Expressions is where we talk about veterans issues, advocacy for our community, and those in our community who help support our veterans. Once again, join me every Saturday morning from 9 to 11, Battlefield Expressions on KCNR 96.5 and 1460 AM.
Shasta County, are you ready for something real special? Mary's Pizza Shack has some changes. We're now Charlie's Tap House, and the Tap House rule number one is come in for the homemade pizzas, pastas, and other house-made specialties, and stay for the beer wall.
Mary's Pizza Shack is now Charlie's Tap House, pizza, pasta, grill. Same family owners and same homemade recipes. Plus, a few more you'll want to try for yourself. Friday nights, try our special hand-cut prime rib for just $28 with all the fixings. And all week, you can enjoy surf and turf or salmon and polenta.
Don't miss Shasta County's premier tap beer wall with your favorite beers on demand that you can order by the ounce. Try our new house beer collaboration with Woody's Brewing, Flippin' Hazy. Your taste buds will thank you. And when you sign up for our Tap House Rewards program, you'll automatically get $5 off towards your next order. Remember, our vibe is casual. The atmosphere is social.
Order online at charlews.com. That's charlews.com.
Hi, this is Linda Bott. Join me for my show, North State Now, on the first Thursday of every month. We'll cover what's going on in the North State, Axiom Theater, local theater.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical